It's blazing hot outside. You get in your car to turn on the AC to get cold air pumping, but it blows hot air out. This issue is commonly caused by low refrigerant due to leaks in the AC system. You want an easy, all-in-one solution that will restore the cold air in no time. AC Pro Recharge Kits make restoring cold air easy for even those with zero DIY experience in less than 10 minutes. Save time and money versus going to a shop by picking up an AC Pro Recharge Kit today. Be a pro with AC Pro.
Welcome to the Ballpark Dimensions podcast. I know you're expecting Mike Petriello, but your normal host, Mike Petriello, is not here today. But this is me, his typical co-host, Matt Myers, national editor for MLB.com. And joining me today as our special guest host and frequent guest is Will Leach, a national columnist for MLB.com. Will, how are you doing today?
I'm very well, thank you. I'm delighted to be here. I'm sorry to disappoint the listeners. This is kind of like this. I'm dating myself in this, but this is back when you would like watch Johnny Carson, but you realize he's not hosting, and the host is like Gallagher or something. Like, I'm just the guy smashing watermelons. Yeah, I'm Gallagher. I'm just like, I've got crazy hair. I look out in the first couple front rows. You're gonna need a tarp because I'm gonna be smashing some fruit.
Well, Mike is on vacation, so we're gonna try and fill his big shoes. And today we're going to talk about the unofficial MLB.com All-Star ballot. We're going to talk about what we want to see at this year's trade deadline. We're going to talk about why seven-inning doubleheaders are good. Then we're going to discover some guys, including the son of a major leaguer you probably didn't notice. It's going to be kind of like remembering a guy while also discovering a guy. It's going to be, you know, sort of like the singularity of remembering and discovering some guys. And then finally, we're going to throw a couple of our purpose pitches, also known as our closing rants. But first, in the segment that we like to call the opener, we're going to talk about Lucas Giolito's no-hitter last night, as well as this year's upstart teams, including Giolito's White Sox, and just how crazy the first round of this year's playoffs could be. Will, did you watch Lucas Giolito's no-hitter last night?
Yeah, I got the alert in the seventh and switched over. And again, this is the first no-hitter in a fanless world, and it really was kind of remarkable to watch because it really all the anticipation was all coming from outside. One of the things I've actually found, generally speaking, watching all of these games with no fans is all the context you bring from it yourself, right? Like ordinarily you can hear the excitement growing in the stadium. And it's weird because ordinarily in a no hitter, everybody leaves the pitcher alone and everyone is real quiet. It was unusually quiet, kind of watching him do that. But and it's weird. I wonder if that's helpful. Like if you're in a situation where there's that much pressure, because again, as I've been to a game in person this year, and it does still have it still feels when you're there, we've done a good job with the television broadcast, but it still feels when you're there a little bit like an exhibition game and a little bit like sparsely attended spring game. So I wonder if that helps when you're in that pressure of a moment that you can actually trick yourself. You can't hear there's no fans getting anxious around you. You can get kind of caught up. You don't get too caught up in the moment because you can convince yourself, hey, you know, this is like a spring game or something. And maybe it takes a little bit of the pressure off because I have to say he did not feel like he was, he felt like he kind of, that was one of those, every once in a while you get a no hitter where you're like, how in the world is this guy pull it off? This guy's pulling magic tricks out of his hat. I think the Edward Jackson 8-walk no hitter with like 187 pitches is the one I remember the most. But this one, it felt like Giolito had it, and it was just a matter of time until he finished it off.
Yeah, in fact, he said after the seventh inning, his quote was, "I thought to myself, I've got six outs. We're going to make this happen. I looked at who was coming up, and I was like, this is very much in the realm of possibilities." And sure enough, that Pirates lineup, as Matthew Puglio of I think that's Puglio of Roto World pointed out on Twitter, of the 10 Pirates who took a at bat last night, 7 of them were below the Mendoza line, and 9 of them were below a .230 batting average. So not the powerhouse lineup that you would. It's not surprising that lineup got no hit. It actually reminded me of Eric Milton's famous or infamous no hitter with expanded rosters in September of 1999. He was pitching for the Twins at the time. He no-hitted a Angels lineup that featured Jeff Devanen, Orlando Palmeiro, Todd Green, Troy Glaus, Steve Decker, Matt Luke, Brett Hemphill, Trent Durrington, and Andy Sheets. How many of those players do you remember well?
All of them immediately and right off the top of my head. I remember David Cone got a little bit of this with his perfect game. I know Vlad was in that lineup, but I think that Expos team was not particularly great either. But again, you know, I love the idea. Imagine being one of those hitters, by the way, where you're sitting there and Giolito, realize now that Giolito is looking at you going, oh yeah, this is within the realm of possibility. These guys are not going to be a problem. And he's right. You know, I think it speaks to just how kind of obscenely bad this Pirates team is at the plate. It's really kind of remarkable. But, you know, Giolito would have got a lot of people out last night. This was also, I take a lot of pride in no hitters of generally feeling pretty confident when the ball's hit that, oh, that's an out. Or like, this is going to keep going or this is over. And I really, I can't be the only one. I think the base hit percentage was incredibly high on that one. When he hit that last bat, I thought, oh, that's down. That's a base hit. The no hitter's over.
Yeah, it was the according to Statcast, it was the highest expected batting average of any batted ball hit by a Pirates batter last night at 850. So it was definitely looked like a hit, but Adam Engel made the catch. The White Sox won again. And you wrote about this today. The White Sox are probably going to make the playoffs. And, you know, it looks like the AL playoff chase is kind of set, but it's kind of set, but also still kind of fascinating.
Yeah, I kind of went off something that, again, when Johnny Carson was here, he wrote about this. I'm here Gallagher to, like, ruin the great thing that he did. But Petriello wrote a really good piece about this at the beginning of the year, talking about the AL middle. Basically, the AL middle. And what he argued, correctly, as it turned out, was that there were obviously two teams in each of the three divisions that were clearly ahead of the other three teams in the division, the Rays and the Yankees in the East, the Twins and the Indians in the Central, and the A's and the Astros in the West. And that has played out. Here we are halfway through, roughly halfway through, depending on how many games your team has played. And all of them are above 97.1% to make the playoffs. They're clearly set. And so what he argued was the AL middle was a race almost between every other team in the division for those last two playoff spots. And what we've seen with the White Sox in the last week, a team that Petriello was very skeptical of, by the way, which is they basically claimed one of those two spots. I think they're actually at 97.7%. They're tied with the Indians right now for second place. Weird things can happen, but by all accounts, it really looks pretty clear that seven of the eight playoff spots are locked in, which is a little bit of a bummer because one of the funds of this season was like, wow, there's so many teams are making the playoffs. Everyone's going to feel like they're in. So the bad news is seven of the eight spots are claimed. The good news is everybody is still alive for the eighth spot and like kind of vividly alive. Cause you know, one of the things that Petriello wrote in that piece was the idea that like, this is a spot that the Red Sox and the Angels are really going to be battling for. And they have the worst two records in the American League. So I kind of went through kind of the race for that eighth spot, because I do think the White Sox are in now. And it's funny because again, the first place right now, first place in that spot is the Blue Jays. They're the only team at 500 at the time that we discussed this. And I think they're the clear favorite, but like literally the teams right behind them. Here are the four teams directly behind them: the Orioles, Tigers, Royals, and Mariners in order, all of which we just assumed the Orioles, we weren't sure they were going to win double digit games for crying out loud. Even the Red Sox and Angels are still alive in this. The Red Sox are only five games out of that spot. To me, that is one of the really fun things is now that we know the White Sox, again, they take a collapse from any of those seven teams to kind of lose their spot. But that A spot, the fact that the Orioles are in it, the fact that the Royals are in it, the fact that the Rangers either might trade everyone or go for it because they're only three games out is really kind of a remarkable thing to watch. And I think one of the fun parts about having the playoffs be the way they are this year.
Yeah, so I mean, it is kind of crazy that I think that, as you pointed out, that it's the Angels and Red Sox that are kind of the teams on the outside looking in. I was very high on the Blue Jays coming into this season, but that was kind of predicated on Vlad being great and Bo Bichette being healthy and great. Vlad's been pretty okay, maybe less so, and Bichette has been great but hurt for like now 10 days. And yet, you know, I think if the playoffs started today, the Blue Jays would be in and they'd be playing the A's in the first round and the A's would be kind of scared.
Yeah, and you know, and we'll get into this when we talk about the Dodgers, but this is the fun of the playoffs this year. It's the idea that everyone is scared whenever they go in there. But yeah, I mean, I kind of looked at the Blue Jays. The Blue Jays are in the top half of baseball in team OPS and in ERA, which, you know, I know those are rough measures, but that's like a good way to finish above 500. If you're both of those things, that's a really good way to be there. And I think that's why they're the clear favorite. They've had issues, obviously, Bichette hurt. I still... I'm telling you what, Vlad Guerrero Jr. is going to be 35 someday, and I'm really going to be like, here it comes. Here it's happening. Here comes the explosion. I know he's only 21, so that's a ridiculous thought, but it really, you always feel like last year thought it was coming, that this was the year. It still feels like it's going to happen at some point. But, you know, the thing about the Blue Jays is for this eighth spot, you literally only have to be average, and it's possible you can be below average. In fact, if you're in the National League, you are in a playoff spot. There are teams that are under 500 that are in playoff spots right now. So the bar to clear is not that high, and I think that's what kind of interesting when you look at those teams like the Orioles, like the Tigers, like the Mariners, those teams that obviously did not go into the season thinking they're going to go for a playoff spot. But heck, while you're here, right? Like I, the Orioles could call up Mountcastle, or I know the Tigers have even like the Tigers have already made some moves, but I don't know, Torkelson, maybe Kelenic for the Mariners. Like there's no, for at this point, you can say, okay, they don't need to go for it. They don't need to mortgage the future for this year. And I think that's true. I don't think any of those teams are going to trade away prospects for a big guy at the deadline. However, if you are this close with a month left to go, hey, a great way to find out something about your phenoms is how they'll handle when they're someday in a pennant chase is to actually play them in the middle of a pennant chase, because believe it or not, guys, you are actually in one, which to me is really fun.
Yeah, over in the NL, I guess the big surprises are the Giants, who if the season have won seven straight as we record this, if the playoffs start today, would be in the eighth spot, and the Marlins, who actually are still, they keep winning games and are in second place in the NL East right now, and would be firmly be in the playoffs right now, not even as a wild card team. So do you think that either of those teams has a chance of maintaining its position?
Yeah, the weird thing about the Marlins is, the thing I kind of like about going to the Marlins in this year is I felt like because their hitting was so bad last year, they added Dickerson, they added Aguilar, they added VR, and like it felt like, okay, they're trying to bump that up a little bit. Aguilar's been okay. Dickerson has not, and VR's not been either. But it's really that pitching. That's the thing that we were excited about from them. And they do have like a lot of these. It's weird though, like a lot of their bullpen arms, it's a team that has kind of the opposite of the way a lot of baseball is now, right? Like all their young pitchers are young flame-throwing pitchers are starters. Like you look at like a lot of teams, you've got the more experienced person that's the starter, and then you have the flamethrower, the bullpen, and maybe you can work them up to that. All the relievers are old. they're traded for Blyer, right? And it's generally kind of working, whereas all of their starters are 25 or under. That is kind of insane in this world. But to me, that's the fun of the Marlins, right? Is that like they have, you know, I think they're different than the Tigers and the Royals and the Orioles, who are really just like, wow, I can't believe this is happening. Let's see what goes. The Marlins were clearly trying to make an effort to be a little better this year. When I did my preview of previews of the season, one of my bold predictions was that the Marlins were not going to finish in last. That's looking pretty good now, but the real reason is looking good is because the Mets and the Nationals and the Phillies are having so much trouble. And I think the Marlins are taking advantage of that. But, you know, we'll see this with the Marlins. You'll see this with the Cardinals. Both of them have kind of came out hot after the little quarantines. We'll see if that runs into a wall at some point. The Cardinals have like a million doubleheaders coming up. The Marlins still have some games to kind of catch up a little bit. To me, that's the issue, is with all the injuries that are going with pitchers, the Marlins can hang in now. They've got it now. But it seems weird to say, are they built for the long haul in a 60-game season? But clearly the way they're running, they're running pretty hot in a way that could cause them a little bit of trouble.
Yeah, I want to point out one thing about the Marlins last night is you probably saw the highlight of John Birdie stealing three bases in a row in the bottom of the sixth inning. And I couldn't help but feel for Mets catcher Ally Sanchez. Most people probably weren't aware that this was his first major league start. He's probably only starting this game because Thomas Nito went on the injured list. The Mets' normal backup catcher. Sanchez is probably not major league ready. He's like a fringe prospect at this point. He was a big bonus baby like 7 years ago. But if you read his scouting report on MLB Pipeline, he's like the Mets' number 28 prospect. And it says like, can't hit, amazing defensive catcher, your classic, you know, backup catcher profile, right? You know, he toils in the minors for six seasons, has more than 1,500 minor league plate appearances, finally gets his first MLB start. Second inning, comes up with the bases loaded and two outs, strikes out. Fourth inning, comes up with two outs and runners in the corner, pops out to center field. Sixth inning, John Birdie steals second base. John Birdie steals third base. And then John Birdie, clearly sensing that this is a deer in headlights, pulls off the Little League steal where he basically takes off as soon as Sanchez lobs the ball back to the pitcher, stumbles on his way home, and yet still scores. Like, I felt so bad for Ally Sanchez last night in his first major league start. It reminded me of a story that I don't know if you saw that Michael Clare wrote on the site last week about Ron Wright, who debuted for the Mariners in 2003. He played in one major league game. He went 0-for-3 and grounded into a double play and a triple play. So he had one game and made 6 outs and 3 at-bats and never appeared in the major leagues again. All I could think of was Ally Sanchez. And I was like, I hope he does not meet the same fate as Ron Wright.
There's something very demoralizing about that. That last steal was actually hard to watch because he did fall down. It almost felt as if Bertie like felt guilty about what was happening, which was kind of amusing. It reminded me of, listen, there's hope though, because I read that white story and I thought it was good. But I always think back to Mike Myers. I remember not the comedian and not the murderer from the Halloween movies. This is a pitcher who's now still hanging around with the Angels organization, but started with the Cardinals in 2016. They needed emergency starter. He started on Sunday night baseball against the Dodgers in 2016. So the Dodgers were still were obviously just starting to get really good here. He was an emergency starter. They were not expecting him. It was a last minute. I think Adam Wainwright was hurt or someone was hurt. Last minute emergency starter. He throws in on national on ESPN Baseball Tonight. Pitches 1/3 of an inning, gives up 9 earned runs, and then was sit down and it was really looked like this was the only time he was ever going to make it back to the majors. He did eventually get called up 3 months later, but I always like, so there's hope, and he became a perfectly serviceable reliever. So your horrible starts, there's hope for you ultimately.
But that play, I thought, is sort of like a little like part of what the Marlins are fast, and they're definitely trying to do this kind of thing. And I think that actually there's like a small edge you can find on the margins in this season of all seasons, where like there's a lot of guys who are being put on the field, who players who are not used to playing together, players who probably aren't major league ready, like Ally Sanchez, where you could take advantage in like little ways of your competition if you're aggressive and sort of like force them to make plays. And it's sort of it makes the Marlins feel a little more spunky when they're trying to pull off stuff like that. But the thing about the Marlins, right, and we talked about them, another surprise team is the Giants, and these are two teams that no one expected to make the playoffs, who could end up as the 8 seed, in which case they would have to face the LA Dodgers. The LA Dodgers, if you have not been paying attention, are absolutely a juggernaut. They are in a 115 win pace over a 162 game season. They have a plus 77 run differential. No one else in baseball is better than plus 39. So basically like twice as good as any other team. And yet there still has to be a little bit of uneasiness going into the playoff for them this year, even if they're going to be playing a team like the Giants or the Marlins in the first round. Am I right?
Yeah, this was the thing with the playoff expansion. It was great news for teams like the Blue Jays or like the White Sox or even like the Indians. It was definitely bad news for the stud teams. Right? That's the problem is, you know, the Dodgers did not need any help getting in the postseason this year. They were going to be in the postseason really no matter what happened. All you can do is all you want to see for them is all they would want out of a season like this is to give, like, maybe you give us an advantage in the playoffs because we're so good. The opposite of that has happened. And listen, the Dodgers are good, are obviously a terrific team. They have lost 2 out of 3 at one point this season. And at some point they will lose 2 out of 3 to a team that is not even good enough to make the playoffs this year. These things happen even in 60 game seasons. So get them in a three game playoff series as we're going to see at the end of this year. I mean, the Giants are one of those teams. The Mets are one of those teams. Imagine being the Dodgers, having this incredible team, and having to face DeGrom in one of the three games. All of a sudden being down 1-0 against a team that in a regular season, you would be like 35 games better than, maybe even more, is truly kind of remarkable. And again, it leads to my general attitude about this season, which is I'm having so much fun, and it's been a relief and a balm for me in so many ways to have these games going. And I think if you end up with the championship this year and win the World Series, not only does it not count, I think you can make a good argument. It is even more impressive that somehow you pulled it all together and pulled this off. However,
yeah, go ahead. I was going to say Billy Beane had a great quote about this in a piece that Mike Lupica did today. When asked about sort of the randomness of the playoffs, you know, Billy Beane is sort of famous for his quote Moneyball of my stuff doesn't work in the playoffs. And Beane said, it's going to be even more random this time. It just is. Listen, I'm not talking out of school here by saying the Dodgers have a great team. They had a great team on paper coming in, and now they're showing it on the field. But look at what could happen to them in the first round. Say they have to go up against a team like the Giants, with the rivalry and all that. The nightmare scenario for them was they run into a hot Johnny Cueto and a hot Kevin Gausman in the first two games. It's going to be everybody's nightmare scenario.
and to me, that's fun, right? Like, I don't know, again, and we'll see what happens, what sticks this year and what doesn't stick next year from this year. But certainly in an ordinary season, it would seem to me like, wow, they have totally cheapened what the Dodgers did in the regular season. The Dodgers are playing 60 games this year. They've been very good during those 60 games, but it's still 60 games. Like, it's hard to say, wow, you've really devalued this completely insane regular season that we're having right now. To me, if there's ever a year to have this kind of playoffs and to have that kind of weirdness, I agree that it is unfortunate that the Dodgers have put together what seems to be a historically great team, and it's happening during a season where there's only 60 games in this playoff structure. Forgive me, but I hope the Dodgers will step in line in the big queue of, wow, unfortunate things about 2020 thing that sort of happened. I'm sorry for the Dodgers, but I'm more grateful that there is baseball. And so I understand that. This is, to me, a good argument against doing a playoff thing like this in a 162-game season, because I do think not only would it devalue the regular season, I think it would really change the incentive structure for a lot of teams simply how good to get in the regular season. I think the Dodgers would not really be incentivized to have this kind of juggernaut if there are this many playoff teams on a regular basis. But in this year, hey man, as Petriello says all the time, let's get weird. And it is a weird year, and it is unfortunate for the Dodgers in this situation. But you know what? There's a whole bunch of things that are really unfortunate for a lot of people this year. So as I said, step in line, Dodgers.
Well said. All right, now we're going to take a quick break, and then we're going to come back with a segment we like to call the three-batter minimum. And now we're going to go with a segment we like to call the three-batter minimum, in which we hit three topics from around the league. Let's go with batter number one, which for this week is the unofficial all-star ballot that we did here at MLB.com. We asked more than 60 editors, writers, reporters, etc., to fill out an all-star ballot, because we're basically at the halfway point of the season. And we picked a team. And I guess I'll run through the team quickly, and then you can sort of point out anything that you really stood out to you as a surprise. So I'll just go through the starters, because we don't want to get too deep in the backups here. The catchers, I'll go the American League first and the NL. American League catcher, Pedro Severino of the Orioles. First base, Luke Voit of the Yankees. Second base, Brendan Lowe of the Rays. Third base, Anthony Rendon of the Angels. Shortstop, Tim Anderson of the White Sox. The outfielders were Mike Trout, Aaron Judge, and Kyle Lewis. The DH, of course, was Nelson Cruz. Starting pitcher was Shane Bieber. And the reliever was Liam Hendricks of the A's. In the NL, we had JT Realmuto of the Phillies, Freddie Freeman of the Braves at first base. At second base, we had Donovan Solano, which I think was the big, maybe would not have seen that one coming. The Giants' standout second baseman this year, Donnie Barrels, as they call him. At third base, Manny Machado of the Padres. Shortstop, of course, Fernando Tatis Jr., the breakout star of 2020. Outfield is Mookie Betts, Bryce Harper, and Mike Yastrzemski. Designated hitter, Jesse Winker of the Reds. Starting pitcher, Jacob deGrom of the Mets. And the quote-unquote starting reliever, Josh Hader of the Brewers. Of those results, did anything really stand out to you?
Yeah, one of the fun things about this, I like to sometimes go back and look at old All-Star rosters, which of course are going off a lot more evidence than we are, and look and see like, wow, that's amazing that that person was an All-Star at that particular moment. But in the moment, it makes sense, right? And so for me, I want to make sure we save this and look back at this in like 3 years and be like, Donovan Solano. Wow, that was what a year 2020 was. That was really kind of a remarkable thing. But, you know, to me, this is such a moving target at every single time you really end up picking these. I voted on this, but it's been a few days, and already things have changed dramatically. Like, since this, Voit was the starter, and then Jose Abreu hit three homers, but then Voit still leads an OPS on the haul. And there are a lot of Orioles, for example. That's unusual. I don't think anyone would have seen that kind coming in this year. But to me, that is the fun of this, is trying to do this is why, even like even when they send out the all-star ballots every year and they make when they put the voting available on the site every year, every single time that happens in a normal season, I'm like, wow, this is like really early. Is it time already to start thinking about all-stars? And it is farther along in the season than we are right now when that happens. So it is to kind of capture this particular moment is kind of fun. The backup reliever here, for example, is Nick Anderson, who's already hurt. We don't know when he's going to be going again. So it's such an unusual, weird kind of year that it's fun. It feels like a snapshot of someone in the middle of a race, but you're catching them like when they're in mid stride, maybe they look a little awkward or their face is a little off. All these guys are good, but it's hard to look at them and be like, ah, yes, the Winker ascension season, as we all predicted. It's hard to look at that and feel like it feels like you're capturing a moment in time even more than you usually are when you pick an all-star.
For sure. I mean, it was mostly like, I was actually surprised how many established stars were on there, but of course, yes, Pedro Severino, Solano stands out. I was pleasantly surprised to see Kyle Lewis make the team. I gave him a call this morning. He was very excited.
I saw his celebration on Twitter. It was really something to behold.
All right, now we're going to move on to topic number two, the trade deadline. It's next Monday, August 31st at 4 p.m. Eastern time. And it's probably not going to be a typical trade deadline with so many teams still in the race, but there will be trades. You know, what do you want to see happen? What do you think will happen?
Yeah, I think it was a good indicator of what this trade is going to be like, of just how excited we were by the Brandon Workman trade. we were really like it's a trade. Oh my gosh, and we understand why both teams did it. And like it was really like, to me, that's kind of what we're looking at this trade line. It's going to be a lot of scraps. And it, for the record, like some of the trade lines have felt a little like scraps, but they turned out to be bigger things. You remember a couple of years ago, you know, the big trade was the Pirates, the Chris Archer Pirates Rays trade, which has turned out to be a total disaster. This feels like a year where no one is going to put themselves in the position of making a disaster trade. And I know there's a lot of bad trades going on. We talk about the Dansby Swanson trade for Shelby Miller, and again that Archer trade, which again I'm proud to say I was on MLB Network at the time that trade happened and said it was a bad trade. And so, and they're like, "What? The Pirates are hot. Here comes Archer." So like I feel it's so very rarely am I right about these things. So it doesn't feel like all the trades. We may see some names moved here or there, and we can discuss some of the names are going to be going. But even if there's like a bigger name, it doesn't feel like anyone for any reason would go all in at or all out really at this year. I think that's what this deadline's missing, is a team like the Pirates, who's just gotten hot in the last week and a half and feels like, I don't know, we're like a couple games behind the Cubs. Maybe we can make a run here. I'm all in. Let's do it. I just don't think there will be any teams doing that this year, frankly, wisely.
Yeah, the one name that keeps being bandied about is like, oh, this guy's definitely going to get traded, is Trevor Rosenthal, reliever for the Royals. He's pitching well for the first time in years. He's not on a big contract, which will make him appealing because every team can always use bullpen help. And the Royals are probably not going to make the playoffs. So like, they kind of checked all the boxes of like why he would be a desirable reliever. But then again, like the Royals are kind of an atypical franchise. A colleague of mine pointed this out. It's like, Dayton Moore, their GM, kind of just like, if he likes someone, like he wants them on the team, like regardless of like where the team's going, he just sort of operates kind of on a different plane. And like, to a certain extent, like, oh yes, obviously they'll trade Trevor Rosenthal. You know, he's got a 1.46 ERA and 17 strikeouts and 12 innings, like, duh. But like with the way that the Royals kind of generally operate, like, I'm not actually certain he will get traded.
Yeah, I'm not either. And for the, he does look good. Like he looks good in a way that even, frankly, I watched him beat the Cardinals on Tuesday night. He looks better than he did during his Cardinals peak. Like he really looks fully, fully healthy. And I know how bad he was for the Nationals last year, that it's hard. It's been so long since he's been so good. He looks terrific. But also, again, I'm sorry, the Royals are kind of in the race. Like, I keep going back to
that too.
But, like, the Royals are kind of in the race. And it's funny, I keep back thinking of that Orioles-Blyer trade that happened earlier this year, right? Where, like, any Orioles fan, at the time that was like, oh, come, like, yeah, how can you trade him, man? He's our best reliever and we're still in this. Like, we were like a week and a half into the year, but it almost felt like churlish and weird for an Orioles fan who again, they've all accepted this is like 3 or 4 years down the line. It almost feels weird to be like, oh, come on, how can you do this? Like, no, but this is exactly what this year's supposed to be, right? It's trading away the assets we have to build to something later. We are still in the long sort of process. Except now, I don't know, the Orioles are a half game out of the eighth spot and maybe could use a pitcher like that. We'll see what happens if the Marlins makes the playoffs and has a big moment and the Orioles miss the game by one or two. Which is to say that, like, the idea, never mind the idea of, like, someone like Rosenthal or what the Royals culture is like, I honestly don't know what a buyer and a seller is right now. Like, the Pirates to me look like the only team in all of baseball that really should be like, yep, everything must go. If you want any of this, I don't know why you would. You should have heard what Lucas Giolito said about us. But I don't know why you would want any of this stuff. But if you do, please take it. I don't know why any other team would be like that. Frankly, including the Red Sox and the Angels, who are the second and third worst teams ahead of the Pirates, but are still ostensibly 1 week away from being right back in the race. And so I know, like, some people talk about Dylan Bundy, that would someone to be traded. And I understand that, again, in a typical year. Absolutely. But I don't know. He's really brought in a lot of stuff for that team to suddenly be like, when you're not, like, not like you're not mathematically eliminated. I think the Angels, last time I saw, are like, they basically have the same playoff odds as teams that are like two or three games ahead of them. They're still hanging around. Like, you never know. It's that kind of year. I can't tell who the buyers and sellers are in the first place, let alone how, like, deals would match up.
Yeah, I think that's sort of what's kind of, you know, kind of messed with the trade deadline a little bit, is the teams you would have expected to sell, the Giants, the Orioles, the Marlins, are kind of in the mix. And, like, so there's, like, no incentive, especially since, like, you know, the returns on some of these trades aren't that great. The one kind of difference maker I could see moving, I think it would make a lot of sense, is Trevor Rosenthal's former Cardinals teammate, Lance Lynn, who has developed into kind of an ace for the Rangers in the last year and a half. And he has one more year left on his contract after this one. So he wouldn't be just like, basically, you'd be getting it for one more year, and it's a very reasonable contract. It's like 3 years, $30 million. So, and also the Rangers, although they were expected to contend, they're, you know, they're 11-18 and have a minus 52 run differential, which is the worst in the American League. So you could see them saying, like, you know, you actually probably could get, like, a pretty decent prospect back or two back. You know, last year, a good comp would be last year, the Mets trade for Marcus Stroman. They from the Blue Jays, and they gave them two pretty good pitching prospects. Anthony Kay, who's already been pitching in the Blue Jays rotation, and Simeon Woods Richardson, who's a hard thrower, who's a year or two away. But, like, I think that would be, like, a reasonable comp. So, like, if you're the Rangers, you can get, like, two, like, legitimate pitching prospects for Lance Lynn. You kind of have to think about it. That's kind of the one name that I think could, you know, he's not like a household name. He's not like a star, but he's the one potential, you know, big name starting pitcher I could see moving and getting a decent return.
And he's terrific. And it's also, like, he's apparently, like, beloved in that clubhouse. They like, he's an unusual, even in St. Louis, he was a quirky personality in a way that tends to work well in baseball. So you can see it, but again, like, just how much will they get, right? Like, that would Lance Lynn, the way he's pitching, forget just this year. He was terrific last year too. I mean, you can make a case that Lance Lynn, the way he's going right now, is one of the 10 best starting pitchers in baseball. Maybe, right? I think you could maybe make that argument. Are you still going to get a? Would you get a top 100? Would you give a top 100 prospect for Lance Lynn right now?
If I were the Yankees, I might.
Yeah.
It's kind of crazy because he was on their team 2 years ago.
Right. And nobody noticed.
Mike and I talking about the podcast, the Yankees, he had, like, you know, he pitched in relief for them and had, like, you know, 30 strikeouts and two walks in like 25 innings. It was like, and then, you know, it was like, he had some crazy run. I think, you know, a team like the Yankees that really could use a reliable starting pitcher, I could see it. The one other name I'll mention before we move on to our next topic that's gotten a little buzz, who I could also maybe see moving, is Josh Hader. Because right now the Brewers are kind of stuck in a little bit of a rut. He's under team control for 3 more years. You always the Brewers are very much like an arbitrage team. They're always trying to kind of, like, buy low, sell high, that kind of thing. And with relievers, they're so fickle. You always kind of want to sell them before it starts to go downhill. And they also have developed a couple of good relievers, one of whom I'll talk about more in a minute, Devin Williams. But I could see it. They're the kind of team that's very aggressive in trading, and they could still compete this year if they traded him because of the bullpen depth behind him. And because he's under control for three more years, you could get something like legitimate for him.
Yeah, it's just that feels that it's funny though, because it feels like all kind of moves you're making this year and looking toward the future are being made a little bit in the dark. Like the number of moving parts that have to come together to trade someone like Hader, who again is still throwing a no hitter this year. He's still in the midst of a no hitter. Like he's been so terrific this year.
To be clear for those listening, he's pitched 9 1/3 innings this year and is not allowed a hit. So
yeah, and to be fair, they've all been Pirates. So it doesn't matter. Every single apparently the Pirate, you just look at the Pirates if you're like, oh, my no hitter's fine. I can't get over that quote. But anyway, so for me, Hader is that's such a big trade, and it's such a big trade in that, like, you know, sure, he's under team control for a long time, but why does Hader get in arbitration in this environment? Like, there's so many like kind of weird angles and weird, we just don't know what 2021 is going to look like, let alone knowing what's going on this year. It just feels like that's a player that big and that good and that central to what the Brewers are doing. And I understand trading a reliever a year or two early, but they didn't do it last year. And that was a time where they could have thought about that. They were just kind of hanging around last year. They did end up making the playoffs, but that was after that weird run after Yelich got hurt. Like, theoretically, that was someone he was talking about a last trade deadline, and they didn't do it then. It feels like a year less control with so many kind of weird things going on. It's hard to imagine everything landing. And also, they're a game and a half out of the second place, by the way. Like, they're still kind of hanging around. And Yelich hasn't even gotten going yet. If I were the Brewers, I'd be real, real careful about doing that.
All right, for topic number three of the three better minimum, we're talking about doubleheaders. You wrote a piece about this last week. The 7-inning doubleheaders that have been implemented for the 2020 season. What is your take on them? Because they've definitely been a divisive topic in the baseball Twitter sphere.
Yeah, this to me is the one you could go either way with some of the things that they're doing in the that they're happening in 2020. There's a big debate whether they're going to happen 2021 or not. The expanded playoffs, to me, I would be surprised to see that next year. But the extra innings rule, I think people have decided they like that a little bit more than they thought they were going to. And I understand why, and I kind of feel the same way. The extra innings, the doubleheader thing is different. And it's weird because all the doubleheaders have been discussed kind of in the context of we got to fit in many of these games as you can. And we have to shorten and keep these players more healthier. And I get that, and I understand that. To me, the question is, the great thing about a 7-inning doubleheader is it changes up. It really, in a way, 7-innings baseball almost feels more attuned to the way that baseball is played now than the 9-inning game. And I'd say that in that, like, already, I find it incredibly strange, by the way, they have not lowered the number of innings a pitcher has to pitch in a 7-inning game to get a win. I know nobody cares about wins, but that feels like an adjustment you should make, because I feel like a lot of times, like, for crying out loud, when you get to like the 4th inning, you are more than halfway there. Who cares if this person gets a win or not? And maybe we shouldn't care, but pitchers tend to care. And I've already noticed several times in doubleheaders, managers clearly pushing them into that 5th inning when they have enough relievers to get themselves the rest of the way, like they would in the 7th or 8th. For me, that's the fun, though. It keys up the urgency of every game. In the 3rd inning, generally speaking, 3rd inning is the, okay, now it's time for, now's the bathroom break time. Now's the, I can miss a couple pitches here. In a 7th inning game, the 3rd inning is a pivot inning. Like, it's like the 5th in a regular game. And I think it increases the level of urgency that you would ordinarily see. I like that. I also think that, you know, I wrote about this in the piece that, like, in Jeff Passan's book, The Arm, one of the things he discusses is the idea that a lot of people think that the way to keep pitchers healthier is not so much to worry about pitching them on a regular basis or too many days in a row, as much as it is don't overdo it and don't make them throw more pitches than they should. This, to me, in a world of openers and in a world of a lot of pitching changes, that's perfect for a 7-inning game. And just from a fan's aspect, it is nice to know that for a 3:15 game, I'm about to go to a doubleheader. I'm actually going to be at the Yankees Braves doubleheader today. And to know that, like, not only are you getting two games for the price of one, you're like, they're both, like, generally speaking, I watched that first Cardinals White Sox doubleheader after the Cardinals quarantine ended was over in like 4 hours and 20 minutes. Now I know that those were two unusually quick games, but it's remarkable, right? In this day and age to have the game stacked up quickly one another. I've been surprised. A lot of people have been surprised by how much they like the runner on second base. I have been surprised by how much there's something less daunting about a doubleheader in seven innings, and it feels more breezy and even a little bit more fun. I find myself watching a regular inning, nine inning game being like, boy, this game's going to go on forever. You know, I've been watching nine inning games my entire life. It's really kind of a remarkable thing.
I know they probably wouldn't ever have done this, but I think there's something about the psychology of it that's confusing. If I turn on a game and if you don't realize, I almost think they should have started games in the third inning. So like if you turn on the game in the middle, you know, like, when it's ending, like right now, if you turn a game in the fifth inning, you don't realize it's a doubleheader, you might like be like caught off guard. And I think players sometimes might get caught off guard where they forget that it's a seven inning game. Whereas at least if you looked up and you're like, oh, we're already in the third inning, you'd be like, okay, we know we're playing nine. It's ingrained in your head. You're playing to the ninth inning. So
that's a terrific idea, by the way. I had not even thought about that, but that's a really good idea. I feel like, but that, I have to say, if you want something that would very much confuse and upset older broadcasters, that's it. A lot of analysts would be like, why? Apparently it's the third inning and we just got here. It feels like something that would upset your more cantankerous older former ball player broadcasters.
All right, now we're gonna move on to my favorite segment of the show, which we call Let's Discover a Guy, which is where both of us will break down a player, one fascinating player that there's a good chance you have never heard of. And Will, as our guest, I will allow you to go first.
So the Somerset Patriots, little shout out to Jersey, love to New Jersey. The Somerset Patriots, who I have actually seen play before, were kind of having a little bit of an issue because, again, like a lot of minor league teams, you can have no fans. It's a hard thing to figure anything out. So they set up this series earlier this year with all like local players and people just hanging around looking for something to do. They created a team called the New Jersey Blasters. And they just put them together for a 13-game series to let them play in June.
An inner squad game? They just like played each other?
They had 13 games. It was between the Somerset Patriots and the New Jersey Blasters.
They put it together.
Yeah, like a 13-game series between them. One of those players in the New Jersey Blasters was a man named Brandon Liebrandt. If that Liebrandt name sounds familiar to you, yes, it is Charlie Liebrandt's son. Charlie Liebrandt apparently had his son older and later in life because his son is now his son Brandon Liebrandt playing this independent league, just hanging around Jersey, trying to find something to do. Came in for the New Jersey Blasters and absolutely dominated the league. Completely dominated the league. He had three starts, had 15 strikeouts, gave up one run, was just absolutely dominant. So the Marlins called him. And this is not like going from, it's one thing to go to like the satellite team and pick somebody up. And eventually he did get a satellite. He's actually now back on the satellite team. But the idea that like Charlie Liebrandt's son was just hanging out in New Jersey and was like, hey, oh, wow, good. This is something we can do to keep the Somerset Patriots solvent. And it turns out he ended up getting called up and making his major league debut this week and pitched really well, pitched four scoreless innings against the Nationals. He's been sent down to the alternate site, a phrase I still have not gotten used to and still feels like Ozzie Smith going to the place in The Simpsons. I still don't like the alternate site. Feels like he's in a parallel universe and fighting like several Spider-Mans. But Liebrandt has been pushed to the alternate site, but he'll be back up. So Brandon Liebrandt, Charlie Liebrandt's son, happened to be hanging around Jersey at the right time in the middle of a pandemic and got himself in the major leagues because of it.
A couple of things I learned about Brandon Liebrandt. He's not a complete nobody. He was a sixth round pick of the Phillies in 2014 out of Florida State. So he has some pedigree. What I also love about Brandon Liebrandt is that even in this age of sort of flamethrowers and, you know, velocity is king, he basically pitches just like his dad, who our younger listeners may not remember, who was what they would call a thumbing lefty or a soft tossing lefty in the 80s for the Royals and then Braves. Brandon Liebrandt throwing a fastball around 89 miles an hour. I'm sure his father never threw it that hard, but that by 2020 standards, 88 miles an hour for your 4-seam fastball is on the low end of the spectrum. In fact, I think the thing I remember Charlie Liebrandt most for, and I don't know what your Charlie Liebrandt memory is, Will. My memory of Charlie Liebrandt is actually sort of like he gave up the walk-off home run to Kirby Puckett in game 6 of the 91 World Series for the Braves, which if the Braves had won, they would have won the World Series. But then, of course, they lost game 6 and then lost game 7, the famous Jack Morris, John Smoltz pitching duel. And then in 1992 in game 6 against the Blue Jays, he gave up the go-ahead double to Dave Winfield in Game 6 that led to the Blue Jays winning the World Series. But Johnny Lebrun did win a ring with the 85 Royals, if I'm not mistaken. Is that correct?
Yeah, you're talking to a Cardinals fan. That is my Charlie Lebrun memory. He was terrific, actually, in that series. He pitched really well in both games that he started. He actually they split the games to get a loss in one, but he was terrific in that series. So, yeah, I remember Charlie Lebrun very well.
All right. Well, my guy to discuss this week is Brewers reliever Devin Williams. Devin Williams was a second round pick in 2013, and nothing really out of a high school in Missouri, never really panned out. He had Tommy John surgery in March of 2017. He had a 5.82 ERA in high class A in 2018. This is a guy that looked like it was just, you know, second round pick. Just didn't work out. And then last year, something started to click in the minors, and lo and behold, now he is one of these like ridiculous relievers that has come out of nowhere, that has like materialized out of thin air. He has a 52% strikeout rate. He's in the 100th percentile for whiff rate and for expected batting average, according to StatCast, which basically means he's making people swing and miss. And when they do make contact, they are not hitting it very hard. And it seems to be entirely because of his changeup. He's gone really heavy on his changeup this year. He throws his fastball at 96, but what he's done is he's now throwing the changeup a lot more. It's almost 50-50 four-seam fastball and changeup, but he somehow figured out a way to take almost 2 miles an hour off of his changeup. So now the gap between his, even last year in his cup of coffee was pretty good, a 40% strikeout rate. But last year, his changeup was 85.9 miles an hour. This year it's 84.1, so almost 2 miles an hour. And suddenly people cannot hit it. Even the pitching ninja himself on Twitter said this is arguably the best changeup in baseball. Williams was asked about slowing down his changeup more. He said it was really trial and error. Throughout quarantine, I was throwing live at bats with a couple of pro guys, a couple of college guys back home. The feedback they were giving me helped a lot. I know if I throw at 88, it's not going to have the depth that it has when I throw at 85. It was just trial and error and seeing what works, what kind of swings I would get, and just letting that play off the fastball. I think that difference between the two is a lot bigger now. It is, and he is one of the reasons why I think the Brewers might potentially consider trading Josh Hader, although we already discussed the merits of that, so I will not belabor that point any further. But seriously, Devin Williams, if you get a chance to watch him, pay attention. The changeup is a thing of beauty. It just sort of like hovers. It's like a Bugs Bunny changeup, as they say. It just sort of hovers about 4 feet from home plate and then drops about 8 inches. And it's really a fantastic pitch. And he is fun to watch. And now we're going to close with our purpose pitches, a little rant to send you on your way. Will, what do you got for us?
I want to credit, by the way, Devin Williams for doing what we all said we were going to do in quarantine, in the early days of quarantine, which is like discover some new talent or like write a novel or something. He found a changeup. Like he did that thing that we all said we were going to do. So good for you, Devin Williams. Speaking of this particular moment in world history, to me, nothing really tickles me more than the changes that we've made when it comes to managerial and umpire fights. There is one of my absolute favorite things to watch is not only, obviously everyone's wearing masks and thank goodness for that. And I think that, I'm glad they've got the protocol on that. It is very fun. It's something amazing about watching, like, first off, the idea of really like a manager barking at an umpire. You're just like a middle-aged man that's like really, really furious at another middle-aged man about something that they're going to forget about in like an hour. Like there's something about like irrational and over the top about a managerial umpire fight anyway, which to me is like kind of glorious. But when you add in the masks, so not only can you not see them yelling at each other, they can't see each other yelling at each other. And because they're trying to be very conscious, they keep pulling their masks up and making sure while they're screaming, as one tends to do when you scream, your mask will move a little bit. They keep trying to pull the mask up and cover their mask. And there's just something almost Three Stooges about it, about watching like a manager who's so mad, but is also trying to keep his mask on and covered. And this is a thumbs down, by the way, for Joe Maddon, who had this situation on Tuesday night, who apparently just skipped the protocol altogether and forgot about his mask. He was so mad. And so credit, because he was yelling at actually two separate umpires without his mask on at all. So down to you, Joe Madden. Remember the protocols. And more to the point, it is funny to watch managers put masks over their face before they go out and yell at an umpire.
All right, thank you, Will. And my purpose pitch will is sort of a bit is actually a bit of a sort of a self-flagellation about sometimes I've counted some pitching prospects out before I should have. In fact, this actually calls back to two of the players we've talked about on this podcast. Lessons 1A and 1B are Lucas Giolito and Devin Williams. People, myself included, do not count out pitching prospects until they have really failed, like failed multiple times as a starter and then failed as a reliever. And then after all that, if maybe they're actually like injured and we know they really can't throw anymore, then maybe we should count them out. Until that happens, believe. 2 years ago on this podcast, Mike and I would mock. We were very hard on Lucas Giolito, saying, oh, he's never going to make it. You know, his fastball doesn't have enough spin rate. He's lost his velocity. It's just this guy was once a big prediction prospect. This guy's done. Last year he was an all-star. Last night he threw a no-hitter. We are so much smarter now about training and pitch development. Pitchers are capable of finding new pitches and reinventing themselves. Even Giolito, he says that when he had Tommy John surgery, it helped him with his find a changeup. And then he went back, he changed his mechanics back to the way he threw in high school. And suddenly, voila, he was a new pitcher. So this is a bit of a, you know, I'm going to remind myself to be humble. And I want to remind the baseball world at large to be a bit more humble, which is, you know, give these pitchers a chance. Sometimes it takes a while. Player development is not linear. There are bumps along the way. And it's really cool when at the end of it, you get guys like Giolito and Devin Williams, who many, many years after they are drafted, after a lot of hype and maybe getting forgotten about a little bit, they come back and show you that they can make good on the potential that they had when they were drafted. And then I will leave you with one cool fact, because this is something that we were discussing in our internal Slack last night about Lucas Giolito. Lucas Giolito, in fact, in 2018, had the highest ERA in Major League Baseball amongst qualifiers. He had a 6.13 ERA, and he actually allowed the most earned runs as well, 118. And we thought, this has to be the first time that someone has led the league, had the highest ERA in baseball and come back to throw a no-hitter afterwards. In fact, it is not. In fact, it is the fourth time that this has happened, which kind of blew my mind. According to the Elias Sports Bureau, the previous pitchers to manage that sort of transformation were Edison Volquez, who had the highest ERA in 2013, no-hitter in 2017. Dennis Martinez, who had the highest no-hitter, the highest ERA in 1985 and threw a perfect game in 1991. And Rick Wise, who had the highest ERA in 1968 and threw a no-hitter in 1971. Of course, Giolito's 6.13 ERA is also the highest by a pitcher in a qualified. It is the highest ERA by a pitcher in a qualified season, who then went on to throw a no-hitter in a future year. I guess to qualify for the ERA title, you have to be reasonably good that they keep putting out there. So maybe there's a little bit of a selection bias there. I was still kind of shocked to find out that he was the fourth pitcher to have the highest ERA and then subsequently throw a no-hitter.
Well, buy stock in whoever is terrible at the end of this year. Get very excited. I guarantee you at some point, if Scott Boras represents that person, he will use that stat for you on some large binder in an arbitration hearing. There is no question that's happening.
Well, thank you very much for filling in for Mike on this week's podcast. That is our show, our Ballpark Dimensions episode for this week, and we will be back next week.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can waste another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can conquer it. I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. Any road. The steeper, the better. Because my all-new Santa Fe is available with H-Track all-wheel drive, so I can hit the trail without a worry in the world. Heck, with three rows and best-in-class rear cargo space, I can pack the whole family in with all our gear. We've got available dual wireless charging for our phones, so we'll never lose touch with civilization, and we won't lose touch with the primordial power of Mother Earth. So which is it? Waste the weekend or do something a little more epic and conquer it in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.